This is Jay Sridhar, and you're listening to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a Rutna podcast. Welcome to the fourth episode of Straight from the Cutter's Mouth. I'm your host, Jay Sridhar. Today's episode, we feature Dr. Steve Charles from Memphis, Tennessee, who is well known in the retina community, not only as a surgeon, but as an innovator. We would like to apologize in advance, as the call quality at times is a little spotty and Dr. Charles will cut out, but we still found his interview very insightful and a good listen from a learning perspective. So without further ado, here's Dr. Steve Charles. Straight to the Cutter's Mouth is now very honored and privileged to be joined by Dr. Steve Charles. We all know Dr. Charles well, but just as a brief introduction, he's the founder and director of the Charles Retinas Institute in Memphis, Tennessee. He is also, I believe, a faculty in ophthalmology at University of Tennessee in Memphis. And besides that, is a pioneer in vitreoretinal surgery instrumentation and techniques and worldwide renown. So, Dr. Charles, thank you for joining us and taking the time.
My pleasure. I'm delighted that you're doing these podcasts. I think it's a great idea, and it'll be fun to participate.
You know, Dr. Charles, one thing I notice is there aren't that many Miami natives in ophthalmology. I'm from Miami, and I saw you are. Where in Miami did you grow up?
My father was professor and chair of art at the University of Miami. We moved to South Miami when he joined the faculty when I was in the third grade, and I went to Sunset Elementary School.
Oh, I grew up 5 minutes from there. You know, it's interesting. I don't know if you know, there's a couple other retinal surgeons from that area. Jeff Heyer told me he's from that area.
I didn't know that Jeff Heyer was. That's
Jeff
interesting.
Jeff Heyer's from and Richard Rosen from New York Eye and Ear as well.
And I know him very well. Sure, absolutely.
So then you took kind of even though you had an uncle, I believe, who was a surgeon at the University of Miami. Is that correct?
No, my uncle that was a surgeon was a world-class colon and rectal surgeon, but he was actually in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And my grandfather that died before I was born was a general surgeon, colon and rectal surgeon as well. And they lived in Milwaukee. And so I was exposed to my dad's oldest brother in the context that he was just such a well-respected surgeon and such an ethical and kindly physician. So that was nice to have that influence. But actually the major influence growing up was I was a mechanical engineer. So there was no question from, you know, before first grade, I was going to be a design engineer, and I've done engineering ever since. But when I was a third year in engineering school, I got from the catalog of combining surgery and engineering, and to design medical devices, and that's what I've all the way through med school in Miami. I built ERG systems and ultrasound systems from scratch, and did laboratory experiments. John Flynn mentored me in the research side, just as the chairman and founder of Bascom Palmer, Dr. Norton, mentored me for both in research and clinically, and gave me an indirect when I was a freshman student, and accepted me the residency when I was at the end of my sophomore year before I even applied. And so I was very fortunate to go to med school, in Miami and be exposed to the people that began Bascom Palmer, from virtually day one in medical school. And I knew I was going to be an ophthalmologist within weeks of starting medical school. I mean,
how did you reach a decision so quickly? I mean, I feel like many medical
students. Well, I've been a machinist. I've been a welder. I was a cabinet maker. So I love working with my hands and precision and detail, and I'm fastidious, so clean, neat, organized, tiny. So I knew I wanted to be a microsurgeon. I didn't have any money. I lived in the VA in Coral Gables. That's where the med school was. I literally lived in the VA for free by being a blood drawer at the VA. So my only recreation was to go watch people operate. So I watched the neurosurgeons. I watched the ENT guys. I worked under the microscope doing in embryology in college in pre-med, and I thought, I want to be a microsurgeon. So I watched the neurosurgeons, the ENT guys. And in those days, ENT was particularly gross with all these radical necks, with, people with infected radical, trachs. And the neurosurgery patients, frankly, were just so depressing to see a brain tumor removed and you can't even speak to the patient. Whereas I was exposed to Dave Sim, who just died this year, who was a world-class Olympic sprinter and a former Bascom Palmer resident, at the time a Bascom Palmer resident practicing the community. And they soon invited me to the OR, Joe Glazer, Danny Jones. So Bascom Palmer luminaries were residents at the time, and invited me up the OR, gave me instruments, and I practiced in the animal lab at the VA. I did kidney transplants on dogs, and they let me do eye surgery. So I read David Patton and Daisy Stillwell's Atlas. I ripped it off from the library at the VA because I didn't have any money. And so they gave me instruments, and I did planned extra caps and glaucoma filtering procedures and iridectomies and things like that. I didn't do retina on greyhound dogs in the lab while they were having, you know, kidney transplants. And so I taught myself eye surgery, and all the time I hung out at Bascom Palmer every available moment all through med school, worked there every summer. You know, nights and weekends I worked in the lab, and I would, you know, skip out from every possible thing in med school in order to spend time at Bascom Palmer. So, luckiest guy in the world to go to med school, you know, in the community where Bascom Palmer was located and get an early start.
What was your first patent, if you don't mind me asking?
You know, I can't remember which was the first one, but there were the three things I did at NIH that got patented. One you probably never heard of is called a syringe drive. It's a way to, with a rack and pinion drive, to run a syringe with one hand. In those days, we used the Visk or the Rotor extractor, and I said, I just don't like the idea of somebody else controlling suction. Mm-hmm. And so I built this thing. Then I built a chin switch, a three-axis switch that ran on your chin that allowed you the microscope, and three wanted to have let's bipolar diathermy on 1 foot and power scissors to do a diabetic traction attachment with a cutter actuation on the other foot. But the stuff that I developed while at NEI that most people know about are endophotic coagulation, internal drainage of subretinal fluid air exchange, the real-time grayscale B scan. So all those I did while I was at NIH. But the other techniques, they weren't patentable. But those are some of the main things I did while I was up there. Then first year in practice, forceps membrane peeling, retinectomy, subretinal surgery, scissor segmentation, scissor delamination. Those were all in the first couple of years of practice, mm-hmm. 75, 77, 78 time frame. And the linear suction was about 77, 78, something like that. And so I've been I developed the MDS, the Accutone 8000, after my friend Colin Malley developed the 800, and that was the first machine with linear suction. Then I started mid-labs and developed the MDS machine with the first disposable cutter, or self-sharpening cutter, with Carl Wong, who's also deceased, like Mockamer and like Connor O'Malley. And then I started Innovision, and Alcon bought it, and that resulted in the Acuras and the Constellation. And, you know, 6,000-7,000. No, I don't even know how many units have been sold. Maybe, I guess, 8,000 or 9,000, 10,000 units have been sold of those machines. So I've been working with Alcon since 1991. It's the only company I consult for.
How do you end up in Memphis? And what was your tie to that area?
Well, historically, I mean, to be quite candid, it was a mistake in the sense that I should have stayed in the high-tech community, like, you know, Silicon Valley or Washington, D.C., where the FDA and NIH are located. But So the good news is I was very, very busy. And the bad news is I practiced with somebody I won't name, but did not do the right thing by me, by patients, most importantly by patients and by the other employees. And so it took me a while to have the courage to leave. So that's how that happened. But you know, it was an unfortunate choice that way. And because that meant that drove, in order to work with high-tech companies, that meant constant travel. Now, later that turned to be a positive because in 81, 82, I learned to fly jets, and I've been commuting to California in the jet that I fly ever since. And so it's, people say, is that your hobby? No, it's not a hobby. It's professional transportation. but on the other hand, is it fun? It's great fun, but so is instrument design, and so is teaching, and so is engineering and operating. So I do the three T's, technique, technology, and teaching, and they all feed off each other, and the jet provides the fast, efficient transportation, so I don't waste time hanging out at Atlanta's airport or something. So that's what that's all about.
How long have you offered a fellowship with your practice?
Back when I practiced with this unnamed individual from 75 to 83, we had fellows, but they only spent a couple weeks with me toward the end. So I had some interaction with them. For mostly they were working with the other guy that was a buckler and not a vitrectomy guy. But as soon as I entered my own practice, which is December of 83, I've been taking fellows ever since December of 83. And initially I took people that did a year of medical retina somewhere else, but there weren't enough medical retina fellowships to really have the option. So we then very soon expanded to a two-year fellowship. Typically we have one a year. A couple times we've taken two per year, and both worked out. So I've been training fellows since 83, and then I've had an associate for, I guess, 12 years, and now a new associate that joined us in July. So now there's three of us, plus two ODs that help us with the optometric community.
What sort of qualities do you look for in prospective fellows? What do you value?
You know, it's communication skills, the perception that they're ethical. You know, test scores count. Obviously, you don't want people that have bad OCAP scores, and you don't want people that trained at a crummy program where they don't get to do much surgery. But if you give me somebody that's kind-hearted and thoughtful and respectful of the staff, or secretaries at the other end say, what a great guy, a great lady, that will be, you know, the highest 2% of OCAP scores. So I don't try to select for people that are going to write papers for me, and clearly I don't have the publication record that Harry Flynn does, but on the other hand, you know, my stuff is engineering, and you don't publish that because of the patent world right away anyhow. So instead of collections of cases, it's all about books and book chapters and getting the equipment out there. And so I don't select people because they're going to write papers for me, to say it that way. I actually fired an associate who remained anonymous for screaming at a nurse. I've had to discipline more than one fellow for not being polite to people. So somebody that's going to be kind, thoughtful, respectful, ethical with patients, with staff, with nurses, with secretaries is just crucial. Obviously, you want people that are very bright and trained at the best possible places and have good test scores. But really looking at character is so important.
You sort of referenced this earlier. You trained in an era where the primary surgical modality for retinal attachment was sclerobuckling. Vitrectomy was just kind of coming into its own in the 1970s. And now you are someone who kind of will openly say that, you know, you feel like vitrectomy is the proper surgery if you're going to do surgery for patient. In every situation, you don't feel like sclerobuckles.
Your voice cut out for a minute, but I think I got the gist of the question.
Yeah,
so let me embellish
a little bit. Talk about your philosophy with sclerobuckles, because you did train in an era where you did sclerobuckles.
I've done 8,000 buckles, but I haven't done one in years. Why? I don't do cataracts. I'm not a vit-ret a phaco-vit promoter. I think phaco-vit's massively overdone and doesn't get the refractive outcomes of doing phaco at as a separate procedure by a phaco surgeon does. So I'm not a phaco-vit guy. That said, I envision myself as being one of the key guys at working with the anterior segment community, and now they do injections, so we have to try to counsel them about sterile technique and indications and which drug and treatment intervals and, you know, treatment stands. But historically, my involvement with the anterior segment community is I joined ASCRS, and I did that to be in the cataract community. I've tried hard to do that. I'm now the head of the Retina Education Committee for the American Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgery. So going to all these meetings, like the Kiowa meeting and running the retina course there, it's not a secret that refractive outcomes are crucial, and that ocular surface disorders matter. Mm-hmm. And so can you ever achieve proper refractive outcomes with a vit buckle? Never. It's impossible. It's completely unpredictable. The late Ron Michaels, and I think it was Bill Smith, your colleague, did a paper that showed on average with an encircling element you got around 2.75 diopters of induced myopia, but you can't predict it. And they also did a paper at Wilmer that looked at strabismus. They sent everybody that, and Ron Michaels was a superb surgeon. He passed away in 91. He's a great surgeon, great friend. And he sent all the patients for a year to the Wilmer Clinic and had the orthoptist do precise pre and post measurements. 50% of the patients had increased fores and tropheus. And he was an excellent surgeon, took good care. He didn't just, you know, jerk the traction sutures in the muscles. He was very careful. And so patients are not real keen on double vision. They're not keen on pain, and they're not keen on refractive error today, because the cataract surgeon today creates a quiet eye without an ocular surface disorder, with relative emmetropia, and with modern day surgery with femto and toric and aura and wavefront and LRIs, etc., they're getting better and better and better at getting the refractive target right on. People are talking about, you know, a quarter of a doctor IOLs and that sort of thing. So we should be stuck with an arcane technology like buckling. And then look at another issue. There's a certain percentage of our patients that go on to get glaucoma for a variety of reasons, steroids, silicone oil, and just multiple procedures or family history or whatever. Well, guess what? Try to do an OMED on a patient that's had an encircling eye. Right, that's right. Not nice, or even a trabec. Then we've learned from our intersegment colleagues that ocular surface disorders count. Well, and I see these, you know, buckle surgeons just pulling up the conj at 3 and 9, and there's a big heaped up conjunctiva at the limbus and, you know, and Dellen posterior to that edge, just completely disregard for the whole ocular surface. And so with 25 gauge or 27 gauge sutureless vitrectomy, you've got a quiet eye, you've not induced any refractive error, you haven't touched the muscles. So I think it's a much better procedure. That said, there's enabling technologies, contact-based wide angle, much better vitreous cutters, but it takes meticulous technique and real attention to the periphery to do a good job in retinal attachment surgery without a buckle. And
right, right. So that's what I was going to ask
you. I think it was hard to learn phaco, you got to learn the trochanter.
So what sort of things do you think you do differently? Because one of the advantages people say about a buckle is you're supporting the vitreous base, but you know, one of the things I've heard you speak about is it's about how you approach the surgery. If you can do it just as good a job or better with a vitrectomy. So what do you think you do differently?
Well, let me give you an example of something that's pretty unusual, but I do a lot of it, and it works very well. Patient comes in, inferior detachment, pseudophakic, phakic, doesn't matter, myope, probably doesn't have a PVD, so-called round hole detachment, as the Brits call it, or maybe an intratemporal dialysis. I do a core vitrectomy very carefully. I don't jerk on the vitreous to create a PVD. What? You don't force a PVD? Everybody does that. Well, not me. I put in PFO, fill it to the top of PFO, laser the brakes. When I go back 2 weeks later to take the PFO out, so now the patient with an inferior detachment can fly on an airplane, go to work, drive a car. Of course, they can't see out of that eye because of the bubbles, but they've got the ability to do whatever they want in terms of mobility, and assuming, of course, good vision in the other eye. And so no laying in bed face down and all that kind of stuff. So when I go back in two weeks to take the PFO out, if they didn't have a PVD at the first visit, the PFO has gently induced a PVD. And it's so nice. Instead of ripping on the retina, trying to make an acute PVD in these patients, which others believe you must do if you're trying to do a vitrectomy without a buckle and the typical myope without a PVD. So there's something that I do commonly. In inferior giant breaks, nasal temporal giant breaks, I put PFO in, leave it in 2 weeks.
Do you leave a tamponade agent at that point?
I might leave air or gas if I'm questioning something, but I'll never put oil in unless it was a PVR case in the first place. I might put oil in. But for the most part, I'll just put in some air. A lot of them are high myopes, and air helps seal the sclerotomies as well.
In terms of gas, so because you're doing that for inferior pathology, do you use mostly SF6 then and not C3F8, or do you use a mixture of the two?
Yeah, I don't use C3F8. And the reason for that, other than, you know, the impact on the patient's lives, positioning, flying, blocked vision, et cetera, the other reason is every paper that's ever looked at tensile strength of experimental choroidal adhesion created by cryo or laser shows it maximizes between 10 and maybe 14 days, but most papers say between 7 and 10 days. So why are you putting in a 4-week, 5-week bubble when SF6 is sufficient to gain adherence? And so that's why I don't, which seems to be the driver in some people's hands. It's all about what I just said. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. I think What about positioning? You mentioned positioning. How long do you have a patient positioned face down, for example, after a detachment?
Well, I find it really ridiculous how the people that do macular hole surgery will say, well, with my technique, I do no positioning. So do you tell patients lay on their back for a week? If you do, it won't work one.
Right.
So if you've got a phakic patient and you say you don't have to do any face down at all, so I don't tell them to stay in bed. I say just tilt your chin down, and that's what you do anyhow when you eat or scrub your teeth or look at a laptop. But you don't want to be in a recliner either. So there, if you're phakic, otherwise you get a gas cataract. So if you're pseudophakic, I say don't sleep on your back for a week. Do every sleep on your side or face down, but don't sleep on your back for a week. Other than that, do everything you want except fly an airplane. If you're phakic, I say, you got to tilt your chin down, otherwise you'll get an acute gas cataract in some patients. I make no effort to remove the anterior vitreous cortex in these patients, so maybe the lens is protected. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to see a patient, that was, had a macular hole pre-op, had the finger counting because they got a big gas cataract, a PSC, mm-hmm. 1 week out. That's no good either. And so that's the reason I do some positioning.
You mentioned macular holes. Let's talk about internal limiting membrane peeling. What situations do you peel ILM?
Every single time I do any form of macular surgery. The ILM, Anselm Kamnick from Germany, taught us that recurrence rates are less for epimacular membranes. My experience with vitreomacular ascites and these high MOBs is they simply, you're not going to fix them unless you peel. I peel symptomatic lamellar macular holes. Instead of thinking of reasons to not do ILM peeling, I think of reasons to do it, how to do it safely. For one, I never use a biome or a resite because I want the ultimate and accurate resolution. Now I'm using Ingenuity, the so-called heads-up to surgery, because I can get even more magnification to do it. And I use Brilliant Blue because ICG is toxic. I happen to have access to a compounding pharmacy where I can use Brilliant Blue. I recognize it's not FDA approved, and some places just can't use it because of that issue about not being FDA, and they're forced to use ICG. But I always use Brilliant Blue. I never use any picks or MVR blades or any kind of scrapers of any type, diamond dust membranes. I use the ILM forceps from Grischaber, so they're truly in grasping. I always use a flat contact lens for visualization because it has better MTF, better axial resolution, mm-hmm. and I always use Brilliant Blue, and I use Brilliant Blue multiple applications. You can't apply and apply and apply with ICG, but you can with Brilliant Blue because it's safe. And so whether it's vitreomacular ascites or lamellar hole or full thickness hole, I don't do lamellar holes to prevent full thickness holes. I do it because they're symptomatic and have, edema, as Ternambi pointed out, on the margins of the hole. So that's why I would offer to numerous airline pilots and neurosurgeons and you name it, that are 20-25 or with VMT. I would never use Jatria. In my view, Jatria is malpractice to use. It dissolves the photoreceptors, and there's no treatment for it in some patients. So I've never once used Jatria, never would. Mm-hmm. So I'm a big fan of using ILM peeling to fix VMT as well as vitreomacular ascites. And
when you peel ILM, again,
I do lamellar holes.
What is your strategy? When you peel ILM, do you have a specific strategy for how you initiate a peel or where you initiate it, or do you just play it basically case to case?
There's two attributes. One is if it's an epimacular membrane, then you're going to where you kind of see the stria, sort of a stellate appearance. So, I go.
We lost Dr. Charles there. Let's give him a call back and check back in.
Steve Charles.
Hi, Dr. Charles, Jay Schroeder. Sorry, I think we got cut off there.
I don't know why, but anyhow, here I am.
Okay. So let's. You were talking about. There's two kind of attributes you look for with ILM peeling and where to start it.
Well, basically, if there's a stellate location in an epimacular membrane, that's usually where the retina is a little more redundant, the membrane's a little thicker. So I've always said inside-out membrane peeling. Instead of searching from some ephemeral outside edge, I'm going to go to the most obvious part. So that's often in the center of it. And so it even can be right in the fovea. So that's, but what's a mistake is to go out temporal where the retina is obviously thinner and the back wall of the eye is curving up towards you, because as the patient moves, if you swing your forceps even more temporally, you're going to ding the retina. I've had two fellows make holes, maybe three, with violent peeling. In all cases, it was temporal to the macula. And I'm always going to use Brilliant Blue, and I'm always going to use a flat contact diet or biome, because you have better MTF, better axial resolution.
Now, a different surgical situation is draining of RDs, and people have different schools of thought about whether you use perfluorine. You talked about a use you use for perfluorine for inferior detachments. But in terms of a primary retinal detachment, let's say a superior detachment, what's your preferred method of draining? Do you drain from the break, do a retinotomy, or use perfluorine?
I've always preferred, I invented draining through the retinal break, 40 years ago, or 41 years ago, actually. And so I always prefer to drain through the break. That said, tiny breaks and or fake eyes often make that difficult. So a big horseshoe tear, I'll always drain through the horseshoe tear if I can. What I don't want to do is displace fluid posteriorly. Right. I've literally made one fold through the macula. Meanwhile, other people seem to do it with great regularity, and it's because of bad technique. So it's always important to initiate draining subretinal fluid before you initiate fluid air exchange. And so if you can create, as Ron Michaels used to say, a flow path, but the real point of it is not pushing all that fluid posteriorly where it's hard to see what you're doing, and you create the possibility of a displaced macula or even a fold to the macula. So initiate draining early on, even if you've got to make a drainage retinotomy. So again, a drainage retinotomy is not something I do preferentially. It's something I do because I'm forced into it from a very peripheral tear in a phakic eye where I don't want to ding the lens, or it's a very tiny tear that's quite peripheral and I don't want to enlarge it. Then I'll be forced to do a drainage retinotomy. I still do a fair amount of them, but I don't just jump in and do it initially. And I try to make a tiny one with a single pulse on the cutter. I don't use diathermy to make it.
Interesting.
And I always use confluent laser around it afterwards. I know Ryan Isom is not doing any laser at all and seems to get good results. Maybe that's the way to go. But for the moment, I never make spots when I treat around retinal breaks. So with a drainage retinotomy, just a fine line of confluent laser around it by using continuous laser.
Why the preference not to use diathermy? Is you feel diathermy is PVR?
It's a wasted step. When you're going to use laser anyhow, why open another tool and put it in the eye when you don't need it?
Makes sense.
I don't use it for retinectomies either. And I don't use it for hemostasis either. I don't use diathermy for anything.
How do you achieve
all hemostasis? All hemostasis is done with laser, because with green laser, 532 nanometer laser, it's absorbed in the hemoglobin column in the vessel, and it confines the energy to the vessel. So you can treat it on the arcades or even on the disc, which you certainly can't do with diathermy. And it doesn't create a wider circle of damage that can result in so-called atrophic holes years later, which I used to observe with diathermy.
You kind of mentioned earlier unmet needs and how certain things you could still see improving. You mentioned you use the heads-up display. Do you think the heads-up display will be something that will be commonplace in our field, or do you think?
I do. I debated against it at the Retina Society Day, not this year, but the previous year, and actually won the debate. But I've had the opportunity to use the new Ingenuity system that Alcon has. I don't have a royal. I was pleasantly surprised that it allows you to use really high magnification. Because it has much greater depth of field, so you're never out of focus because it has small apertures. And so greater depth of field, the enabler then of high mag, where you look with foveal vision around on the image instead of using mesopic vision surrounding foveal. And then by using post-acquisition color gain control, you can make it look yellow, so that means Brilliant Blue, which should be renamed Not So Brilliant Blue. It makes it much more visible. Those that are ICG users can dilute it at least 10 times, maybe 100 times, and by having a reddish-looking light, it's not light, it's the filtering after you acquire the images. By changing the color gains, you can make your picture look red, and therefore the ICG is much more obvious. And interestingly, if you make it look like a blue picture, you can see vitreous better. Haven't completely figured that one out, but there's no doubt that it's true.
Interesting. Do you think that we'll see a lighted cutter in the near future?
I've worked with them in the laboratory with Alcon, and I really I think it's a possibility. There's certain intellectual property, not mine, and but I really don't know what the game plan is in terms of that potential product. It does work if properly executed.
What about robotic surgery for retinal specialists? Do you think that will be part of what
it's
we do?
Ridiculous. Those who talk about it simply don't know what they're talking about, and I've heard it so much. Mm-hmm. I've spent $50 million in 20 years building robots, but I built them for neurosurgery and spine and ENT because my dad died of a brain tumor, and he asked me to work with the neurosurgeons, and I did. And I built a big company, and I sold it to Stryker. So I know a ton about robots, far better than the ones you hear from this press release from England and from some others that worked on. What's wrong with it? Why not eye surgery? Two reasons. The main reason is this. We do surgery under local anesthesia. When they said, well, they're using it in neurosurgery. Well, they're getting started using it in neurosurgery. But here's the problem. In neurosurgery, not only are the patients under general, but they have neuromuscular blockade. But once more, they literally have screws in their skull. So you have a solid mechanical reference. So if the robot's attached to the main, but you can't do that in ocular surgery. And so people like the guy at Columbia at one point were pushing it. They say, well, we have a remote center of compliance, which means it pivots around the pars plana. Hold on. You've got a sharp instrument in somebody's eye and the patient has sleep apnea. They wake up and move. There is no tracking technology. Just that is completely unacceptable from a risk perspective. And there's no way in the world. It's ridiculous.
Well, I know you have to go, Dr. Charles, and you're very busy. So last quick question, kind of thoughts, you know, how do you balance you are self-admittedly very into fitness. You keep yourself fit. You believe that staying healthy and eating well and working out is part of being a surgeon and taking care of your patients. But how do you balance that with as busy as you are?
Because your phone cut out a little bit, but go ahead. Sorry.
No, I mean, I mean, you're someone who has, for example, you told me you have over 10 vitrectomy cases tomorrow. You saw a full clinic today. You're doing interviews tonight. How do you balance that with being a surgeon? And what advice would you have for fellows as they enter their careers?
Well, unlike a lot of people, I have no interest in, for want of a better term, being amused or entertained. So I have absolutely zero interest in Hollywood movies or concerts of any. I watch a little sports on TV with the sound off of my laptop in my lap. Most important to me in my life are my three daughters and my grandkids, and I'm very close to them. They don't live in Memphis. All three are married.
Two of your daughters are physicians, correct?
Extravagantly successful and great people. Two of them are physicians, and the third one is a team building expert that's built an enormously cool zip line in Austin, Texas, a huge zip line project with six tandems over this wonderful 2,000-acre park. So great kids, they're first number one. But, you know, I'm single, and they don't live in my city, so I don't like hang out with them at night. So what do? I work out 5 days a week. I do cardio 2 days and 3 days. I'm benching 250, leg press about 600. I don't drink. I don't watch movies. I haven't been on vacation in 21 years. I haven't watched a movie in 30 years. So I study and I work out and I work. So I do surgery, engineering, teaching, jet, and work out. And that's it. But I eat real, real healthy, and I want to sustain this career. If I can work on 95 or 100, I will. I mean, I have zero interest in taking a vacation or retiring. Zero. If I'm spotted in a cruise ship or a zip line, or a call the funeral home.
Well, Dr. Charles, it's good to know you're going to be with us a long time, I think, and you're an inspiration to a lot of us. And I really appreciate you taking the time to come on this program and share your thoughts.
Keep up the great work on Retina Podcast. It's a great idea. I'm glad you're doing it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Hopefully we'll have you back on in the near future and we can talk some more. I really appreciate your time.
I'd be delighted to. Enjoyed it.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Charles. Have a great day.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Dr. Steve Charles from Memphis, Tennessee, and we'd like to thank Dr. Charles for being generous with his time and providing us with an excellent podcast today. As always, you can access our podcasts, current and old, on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINA podcast.com. You can subscribe to us there or in the iTunes store. We're constantly looking for feedback or ideas for future episodes. Again, our goal is to be here for you, the listener. So please feel free to email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com or leave feedback on our website by clicking on the Contact Us link. Future episodes, looking forward, before Thanksgiving, we should have Dr. Charlie Wyckoff, as well as another young VR surgeon spotlight coming out later this week. In addition, look for our first Retina Roundtable to hit the website right before the Thanksgiving holiday. This is Jay Sridhar signing off. Thank you for listening, as always, and we'll see you in a few days.